it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Well, good Saturday morning. Hope you're having a good weekend. A little rainy, but what do? Right? You enjoy the rain. 101 with Greg Pogue. Presented by Freeman Webb. We're at Roy's Meat Service here on 94.9 The Man. Jake Steigelfest producing. Well, I have a friend of mine that I've known for years, okay? He's the two-time International Bluegrass Hall of Famer as the group Newgrass Revival, Lifetime Achievement Award with the Americana Music Association, the Kentucky Music Hall of Fame, my longtime friend and baseball aficionado, Sam Bush, but he couldn't make it. He just stood me up. But he sent Harry Carey instead.
Hello, everybody. I'd like to be here at the Beat Market with my friend Craig Pogue. Good-looking ball player. Hey, he's a right-handed hurler for the Brewers. Let's see some of the kids' stuff. What do you think there, Craig? You like here at the Beat Market? What are the specialties down here that old Harry might like?
Well, there's a wall of beer.
Hey,
there's Budweiser.
They got Bud, cause I'm a Bud man and a Cubs fan, of course.
Don't say the Cubs.
Hey, what do you got to worry about? You're in first place.
Well, yeah, we are. We won five in a row. How you doing, Sam?
But who's counting? Five in a row.
including the Cubs last night. How you doing, Sammy?
I'm doing great. It's been, so far a good summer. And I mean my band and I, we've just gotten back from Telluride, Colorado, where we do the somebody asked, why do you say Colorado? I said, because when we first started going there, that's the way all the cowboys out there said it.
Yeah.
and we're more native.
You were opening for Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys then, right?
I'm old, but maybe not quite that old. No, we just got back from the 53rd annual Telluride Bluegrass Festival. And
do you have perfect attendance?
I do. From when we the Newgrass Revival started going, we came to the second one, mm-hmm, in 1975. So that was this one was just my 52nd consecutive. Notice I didn't say straight, but I did say consecutive.
Nothing about it. So, at what moment along the way did you stop taking that bus and fly?
The first number of years we weren't in a bus by any means. We'd take a van. Two cars, and our banjo player Courtney was from Hicesville, Kentucky, and he was a Cracker Jack shade tree mechanic. I mean, he literally, I had pulled up to his house once where he lived in Hicesville, Kentucky, and he literally had the car under shade tree with a big log chain hoisting the engine out to rework it. And so that is a shade tree mechanic. And he was a great one. And we'd get out there, and we'd get about halfway into Colorado, and then he'd give the signal, and we'd pull our cars over, and then he'd readjust our carburetors for the altitude. People don't do this anymore.
No, that's why they make checkbooks.
But also there was no such thing as I-70 wasn't complete at all,
yeah,
across Colorado. So we would we get in these giant construction holdups, and then we got CB radios. So then we started, signaling each other. Courtney would go first and pass a bunch of cars and tell me, okay, nothing's coming for a mile. Go. We did that, and all of a sudden, I think it occurred to us one day, what if somebody pulls out in the meantime?
Yeah.
Since that last happened, and a truck driver who was actually trying to watch out for us and was friendly, he said, "Hey, Kentucky boys, they'll nail you to the cross out here if they catch you doing that. Don't be doing that. And so,
and they didn't have any contraband with you either.
No, not at all.
No. Are you kidding me?
No, back then, one of the things we'd always do was Coors beer was not in the East yet in the mid-70s, so we'd just get cases of Coors to bring home. And, of course, what we found out is we just consume it more rapidly because we had a lot of it. I didn't start riding in a bus out there. I mean, Newgrass Revival, we never actually had a bus. We had a bread truck, a converted step van, which was great. We had five bunks in it, and we owned an generator, and it was just wonderful, and it helped us to be able to afford to have a band. We weren't working to pay for the upkeep of a bus. Now we rent them, or me and the band rent them. But I didn't really start riding in a bus till went to work for Emmy Lou Harris in 1990.
Really?
Yeah. and boy, was that Shangri-La.
Yeah. Yeah. Sam Bush, our guest, 101 with Greg Pogue here at Roy's Meat Service, presented by Freeman Webb. Sam, 14 times nominated for a Grammy, 3 times you've won a Grammy. Which is of those 11 you didn't win did you think you should have won? Because it's not a contest. I mean,
it's not really, and it depends on the Grammys are. You know, that's a wide voting thing, and I realize that sometimes I think there was one for an instrumental that John Randall and Byron House and I wrote that I thought, well, you know,
Byron House, Bowling Green Boy.
I thought we deserve, you know, that should have won maybe. But really, I mean, Grammy voting, it does revolve around who the voters know the name of. And that year I realized I was probably, as a Grammy voter, I was probably guilty of that too, because sometimes I would, you know, I'd be looking in the reggae division, for instance, and I knew there's, you know, listed in one of the nominees be Ziggy Marley.
Yeah.
That's Bob Marley's son. Oh, okay, I'll vote for him.
Right.
Had I heard the record? No. So I stopped voting for anything that I hadn't actually heard, in all fairness, at that point. But it's hard to know. I mean, yeah. it's such a – but on the other hand, I do – I think maybe the Grammy my Grammys are in association with people, and the one that I think I'm most proud of is the one with Emmy Lou Harris and the Nash Ramblers. We won Country Vocal Group of the Year. Mm-hmm. Now, here in Nashville, the way the music business works and country music radio and what have you, that record wouldn't have been up for consideration, say, in the CMA Awards. Mm-hmm. But in the Grammys, the voting was that those voters, they know Emmy Lou Harris. And so, in that way, maybe that one worked out for us. But I take the most pride for that one because we won it for Country Vocal Group of the Year for a live album at the Ryman Auditorium. Mm-hmm. And at the time, the Ryman was virtually condemned.
Well, and there's a documentary also. Oh, let's. I don't want to bury the lead. Don't bury the lead. Tuesday night. You're headlining at the Ryman Auditorium.
Yes, and part of the Tuesday night bluegrass series that goes on. I'm not sure how many weeks it actually goes, 6 or 8 weeks in the summer. And so it's a great situation to be in the Ryman Auditorium. I mean, you know, being from Bowling Green, started coming down to the Ryman when I was probably 13, maybe. First, my dad and I first came down, and we'd made the acquaintance. Remember when the Bowling Green television station was called WLTV, which stood for Wonderful Live Television? So they said.
Channel 13.
That's right. And a band used to come up from Nashville called the Homesteaders, and one of the guys in the band was Jerry Rivers, who was Hank Williams' fiddle player. And so my father, being an incredible Hank Williams fan, really, we went to the station and made their acquaintance, and Jerry Rivers was a great guy, and my dad would give him dogs, you know, so he got us backstage at the Grand Ole Opry. So first started getting to go to the Ryman when I was 13. And I, you know, yep. And any time I'm there, I can still look up and remember where I was sitting that night and hearing Bill Monroe. And
it's still walking out on that stage has to be a surreal in a way, doesn't it?
It is kind of surreal, and as well, especially that I didn't grow up there, but I grew up loving, you know, music from that room, and it is surreal, and it can be a little intimidating. It might take a couple of numbers to settle down.
Mm-hmm.
It really does.
Yeah.
And so when Emmy Lou was, when I was in her band, she'd had the band maybe about a year, and called up and said she wanted to make a live album. I said, great, you know, we're rough and ready now. Let's do it. She goes, well, I want to do all new material. I said, great. And she said, I want to record it at the Ryman. And I said, I'm under the understanding the Ryman is condemned. Now, this is 1991.
Early 90s, right.
And
yeah.
I think it might be condemned. And she said, well, then we got to do it there. And so.
Well, you essentially, that whatever you want to call it, event. It wasn't a concert, okay? An event really was a catapult for saving the Ryman Auditorium.
Oh, I think it was. I think Emmy Lou Harris saved the Ryman. And we recorded there 3 nights. Bill Monroe, Emmy was taking buck dancing lessons, and so Bill Monroe came each night to dance with her while we played a Bill Monroe tune called Scotland. And so, but that record, because I don't believe we were able to accommodate more than 300 people in the room. There were holes in the floors, holes in the ceilings, one working bathroom. I mean, it was in terrible condition, but Emmy Lou said something about, we're going to shake the hillbilly dust off the rafters in here. And the sound of the album, really, the sound of the room is part of that sound. And I really believe that she saved that room, and it raised the visibility back to not tear it down.
What a sad thing that would have been, man.
Yes, and you know, I couldn't remember as a kid. Yeah, the entrance was on 5th Street before it was all redone and everything.
The church.
Yes, it is the mother church of country music, and I think it originally was a church, wasn't it?
It was a church, yeah.
Worship services.
Yeah, Ryman, the riverboat captain.
Captain Ryman.
And, yep, Sam Bush, our guest. There's so many places you and I, we've known each other 50 years. You know that?
Yeah, we have.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
We've known each other 50 years.
And you go,
oh, wow. I don't want to form
what
that. Yeah, really. Well, but
just glad
you mentioned Bill Monroe, the father of bluegrass. You have now considered the father of newgrass. But to get Bill Monroe to come to anything you had to do with times change, obviously.
Well, times did change.
But when you came around, I mean, you were a mix of newgrass, Robin. We're going to get into the history of that after this next, our first break here. But it was, and I had the very first album, Barron County. I loved that one. That one was, I think, was the one that this is where we are. I don't know. Yeah. Just put words in your mouth. But you're talking reggae, jazz, bluegrass, rock. Yeah, it was like just a big old gumbo of things.
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, me being born in 52, as we were growing up, we had from Bowling Green, we had the advantage to see Nashville television.
Mm-hmm.
Us out on the farm. Now, my dad had to climb on the roof sometime and readjust.
Up in Hadley,
almost in Hadley, and but we grew up with the getting, because there weren't as many divisions, so to speak, in music or categories.
Right.
It was all just...
Or genres or subgenres.
Right, right. So, yeah. You know, you'd have... we got to see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. When the folk boom hit, Hootenanny was a major ABC show. Shindig, great rock and roll show. Then later, when the Smothers Brothers, Glenn Campbell show featured all these, and then
which had John Hartford.
John Hartford and Glenn Campbell did a jam in the middle of every show for about 2 or 3 songs, acoustic, and that was pretty great. And not to be forgotten, also how important the Johnny Cash show was on TV, where you just saw live music, you saw people actually playing. And it wasn't just videos. And you'd have Mason Williams playing classical gas right alongside, you know, the Stones trying to break the rules and sing Let's Spend the Night Together.
Yeah.
And then there'd be the Jefferson Airplane or Simon and Garfunkel. And then, or you'd have people, you know, the great bluegrassers here in Nashville. We got to see, you know, on local Nashville Channel 4 and 5, you'd see Osborne Brothers, Bill Monroe, and Jim and Jesse. And of course, each Saturday afternoon, there was like, was it 5 half-hour shows? Where certain country stars, Opry stars, have their own
so
show.
So that's what you grew up on.
Yeah.
In a lot of
but
ways.
TV. So yeah. TV was my friend.
But Bill Monroe wasn't.
Not necessarily.
Not at first. You were taking it out of some boundaries that he thought were his.
Yeah. I was fortunate to grow up by being influenced by Bill Monroe. And seeing the Stanley Brothers, seeing Flatt and Scruggs live, and the originators of the music, I got to see them. But I was also more turned on by the people who had already deviated from the old-time ways of bluegrass, such as the Osborne Brothers, Jim and Jesse, the Dillards, who a lot of people know them as the Darlin family, and Andy Griffith.
Andy Griffith, all right.
And from Washington, D.C., the Country Gentlemen. So... I had the advantage of being influenced by people who already were making progressive kind of bluegrass. And John Hartford on the Glenn Campbell Show was part of that influence, mm-hmm. too. So we kind of took it even further and now expand because we were now influenced by, say, you had the Cream or the Allman Brothers that were extending their jams. But also a friend from Bowling Green, Ken Smith, gives me a record called The Best of Atlantic Jazz where John Coltrane played My Favorite Things for like 8 minutes and did an extended jam. And that was the perfect introduction to a hillbilly like me to hear John Coltrane because that melody of My Favorite Things was a melody I could relate to. It's from a movie. And so we were influenced by the idea of it making jams and just playing, playing for a while. So that was probably pretty foreign to Bill Monroe's ears. And plus we also broke tradition by not dressing, you know, I mean, it seems
you're a bunch of damn hippies.
We were hippies. And you know, we were actually, you know, we just looked like a whole lot of other people that were our age at the time. But we didn't. Mm-hmm. Put on special costumes to play. We kind of wore what we had on. And,
yeah.
But then again, that's what we owned, too, at the time.
Sam Bush is our guest. Let's take a break. We are at Roy's Meat Service 101 with Greg Pug, the 14-time nominated, 3-time Grammy winner, Tuesday night at the Ryman Auditorium. You're listening to it on 94.9 The Fan. 101 with Greg Pug, presented by Freeman Webb. We're at Roy's Meat Service, East Nashville. Oh, by the way, this afternoon at 4 o'clock, F&M Bank Arena, the last regular season home game of the Nashville Cats against the Beaumont Renegades. A salute to military, red, white, and claws out to Congressman Van Epps, military. That the 101st Airborne Rappel Team is going to rappel from the rafters and deliver the game ball to the referees for the coin toss.
Wow.
We got the 101st Airborne Brass Band doing the national anthem.
Majestic.
Yeah. You know who's going to come do the national anthem? Hopefully August 1st, maybe. Our friend Jeff Coffin. Of course.
Really?
Yeah. Of course, you and the Bailiff Fleck. I'm going to talk about that in a minute.
I bet Jeff Coffin does a beautiful job.
Yeah, he does. He get this, you baseball fan. He is... In the next week or two, he's going to do the national anthem. He's done it before at Fenway Park before a Red Sox game.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great.
Newgrass Revival is the centerpiece of your story, okay? You know, Courtney Johnson, Curtis Birch, Ebo Walker, and then we just mentioned Bela, John Cowan, yep. Who's now the bass player and vocalist for the Doobie Brothers.
Uh-huh.
Go imagine that. Where did it? Give me the genesis of it.
Well, we started. Newgrass Revival was the offshoot of a band called the Bluegrass Alliance, and we had a 5-piece band. And basically, we had a falling out with our fiddle player, and we wanted to fire him quite bluntly. And so we had this meeting, said, we want you out. And he said, you can't fire me. I own the name. And son of a gun, he did. He had it trademarked in the state of Kentucky. He literally owned the name of the band. And so we one of us, maybe me, said, well, let us put it this way. We all quit. So four guys quit a five-piece band. And we went for a few months where we didn't know what to call ourselves. We tried Walker, Bush, Johnson, and Birch, and that sounded like a really failed law firm. So we at the time in the early 70s, people were using the word bluegrass and offshoots of how can you use the word bluegrass or the word grass or what have you. Like we had friends in D.C. had a band called the Grass Menagerie. Mm-hmm. But the Bluegrass Alliance had called their second album Newgrass, which really seemed fitting for a newer kind of bluegrass, more progressive. So at the time, we thought, well, that name sort of applies to us. And with Revival, we really were kind of trying to point out there already was a new kind of bluegrass, as I mentioned earlier, who the people we were influenced by. And maybe because the Creedence Clearwater Revival was popular at the time, and thought, hey, Revival, that's a good word. It seemed like a positive thing that maybe people could jump on that bandwagon. And but we at the time played a lot of colleges, and college age people were my age then, and lots of colleges would have like these coffee houses. And it was popular then because, for instance, Crosby, Stills and Nash, James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, you know, acoustic guitars and acoustic style music, maybe Simon and Garfunkel, same thing. That was popular within rock and roll. So young kids, young hippies were digging acoustic sounds, and bluegrass was something they could relate to. The New Riders of Purple Sage were getting popular, and the Grateful Dead had made Working Man's Dead, which, you know, went a little more acoustic. So the rock and roll audience was embracing us, and we became we opened for and we got into all kinds of opening act situations. I mean, we opened for a lot of people. It was
such as
remember the band Goose Creek Symphony?
Yeah,
we them, Jesse Colin Young,
Songbird,
of course, John Hartford, the Dillards. One time, one of the greatest packages we were ever on was in Memphis, was the Newgrass Revival, John Hartford, the Dillards, and Ike and Tina Turner. and then we in 1973 we lucked into opening for Leon Russell when he was number one Billboard box office attraction in the world, and it was insane. And it was terrifying.
What was that, Will of the Wisp, that era?
No,
that was before then,
this
right?
This was his album like called Leon Russell and the Shelter People.
Yeah.
Maybe his second
live album where his wife's face was painted white.
That was right after Carney.
Yeah.
And we were playing to an average of 25,000 people a night, and we were this bluegrass-style band from Kentucky. And the first few shows, I mean, it was terrifying. You know, yeah. We had never experienced anything like that. And so 2.5 months in 1973, we did that. And it was an unusual situation because we were employed by Leon and the Shelter Corporation. So we rode in his private plane. We stayed in the same hotels. We rode on the band bus. And that's just not the normal thing for a front band. Front band is just kind of like you get there, you get whatever money's left over, and that's what the front band does. We went right back down to earth when, as the tour ended in Long Beach, California, we got to go on to the Queen Mary for the last night private party. We got to meet a person who was visiting there that we never thought we'd meet, George Harrison. And just it was just insane the whole trip, and then we came right back down to earth 2 days later, we were right back to our normal circuit, playing 2 weeks, six nights a week at Arnie's Pizza King in Lafayette, Indiana. So that was exactly what we did. And then, back to fronting people. And one of the funniest front band jobs we ever had was two nights in Atlanta, opening for Cheech and Chong. Hey, Cheech and Chong's audience just came to hassle them and throw stuff at them. So
yeah.
What do you think they wanted to do to a band that had a banjo in it?
It's Sam Bush with us, our guest, 101 with Greg Pogue, multi-Grammy winner, Tuesday night headlining at the Ryman Auditorium, and just a long time bud. John Cowan, game changer, what of the vocalist of, angels are singing and they come out of his mouth.
Yeah, nobody can sing like John.
Yeah.
And when we first started, John was actually our third bass player, our original bass player named Ebo Walker, and then a fella named Butch Robbins, who's a fantastic banjo player, played electric bass with us for a year. Butch actually left. He's the only guy that ever left Newgrass Revival to go play with Bill Monroe. Which is what he did.
Yeah.
And he played banjo for Bill Monroe for a few years. But when we met John, we had heard about this. He was recommended by our friend Ken Smith from Bowling Green. They said, I know a guy that might be really, really good. He's a very, very fine electric bass player. So he came down to Courtney's house with a great guitarist who's lived here in Nashville all these years named Tom Britt. So John and Tom came down. And came down to Courtney's house. And, of course, for John to roll up in the middle of Barron County, Kentucky, with hair down to his waist, he thought he was stepping into deliverance, right? And I remember he gets his bass out, and he's just tuning up. And just the way he hit the strings and tuned his bass, the other three of us looked at each other and go, wow, he's a real bass player. This is going to be great. So, and this is true. So we played a few songs and asked him to join the band.
Yeah.
And then he said, I sing also. Can I sing a song? Picture me as Barney Fife saying, go ahead. I mean, I'm the lead singer in the band, but you go right ahead. Sure. And he sang his version of an old bluegrass song called Some Old Day, and our jaws kind of dropped. And I said something like this to the effect of, after he got through with that song, I said, well, okay, I used to be the lead singer in the band. It's gonna be you.
Yeah.
Because we all of a sudden had a singer that could make a noisy bar room audience stop talking.
Oh, yeah.
And listen to
it. Well, and then now, just fast forward, as we mentioned earlier, he's now the bass player and the vocalist with the Doobie Brothers.
Yeah.
Bela Fleck. How many Grammys has he won? 20? 15?
One time, about a year or two ago, Bela and I have only gotten closer since the band broke up. I mean, we actually stopped playing in 1980. Our last gig was New Year's Eve, 89. Mm-hmm. So we didn't make it into the 90s.
Yeah.
But anyway, Bela and I are close. We just did play together out in Telluride. But about a year or two ago, I said, how many Grammys do you have? And he goes, I don't know. I said, I don't believe that. I think everybody knows
it's 15?
At least, probably.
Yeah, 15 or 20 Grammys.
And one of the things he's really smart about is, his talent just leads him there. He'll make records in different genres, like,
Chick Corea.
Right. Right. Duet records with Chick Corea.
I mean.
With Edgar Meyer in classical. Bela's, within the last couple of years, he learned the entire, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and banjo players, many people marvel, they go, that's impossible. That's impossible to play. And only Bela can do certain things. Right now, I've just been listening to it, and I got to play on it years ago. And then the project was stymied. It's a record with the incredible opera singer Renee Fleming. And she's doing like Americana folk-style music, and Bela produced the record.
Wow.
And Jerry Douglas and Bela and I and some of us played on that. And it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And Dolly, she does a duet of this old Bill Monroe song called In the Pines with Dolly Parton. Now, it doesn't sound like Bill Monroe, but Dolly Parton and Renee Fleming are like voices of angels. So Bayless, he's interested in just everything. And of course, he won I don't know if he won the Grammy, but he, a few years ago, and he used different ones of us on a record called My Bluegrass Heart. So he likes to switch genres, or last year at Telluride, he had a trio
with a
drummer and a harp player.
Here you go. How many Grammys has Bela Fleck won?
He's asking his phone, ladies and gentlemen.
18.
18. Let's call him and tell him.
Sam Bush is our guest, 101 with Greg Pogue, presented by Freeman Webb. We're at Roy's Meat Service.
18 Grammys for the kid.
Yeah, and Harry Carey stopping by one more time.
Hey, that's like two games.
or one long one, right? Yeah. More with Sam in just a minute. Let me tell you about the Boulevard Bar and Grill, 2154 Middle Tennessee Boulevard. Jeff Neville, Leia, Tay, the general managers there, great people every Monday. Well, during the football season, that's where the MTSU Football Coaches Show is. Derek Mason, hosted by The Voice, Chip Walters. And then he does the men's basketball. I host the women's basketball there. Just a great place. BoulevardBurfreesboro.com. They actually have a patio where you can bring your dog. Not only that, they have a dog menu that you can order. Now, they don't have, like, you know, dog food. They have, like, you know, burgers.
I see.
Yeah. So
bring the pup.
Bring the pup right there. The food's great. Specials, everything. It's where I go. It's where I go when I'm in the borough. Boulevard. I don't know if that's good or bad, but Boulevard Murfreesboro.
I think it sounds good.
Yeah, I got more with Sam Bush right here on 94.9 The Fan.
Hey, old Harry spent the night in Baton Rouge with a girl. Her race, hey, it has sweet lead wine. I need a couple of cups of coffee and maybe a martini or two. Call him Baton
Rouge.
Well,
hey, keep going with that, Jake. Does John, when does he start singing? Is this the instrumental version?
This is the track to – this must be the karaoke track to the Garth Brooks version. Because this is the track to the Garth Brooks version because it's Jerry Douglas is on Dobro. Of course, Newgrass Revival, we recorded this song. It apparently – we didn't know. Maybe a couple other people had tried it out. But when we had our deal on Capitol Records in the late 80s, I played on a demo of this song Randy Scruggs produced.
Yeah.
And I said, can I have a tape of that? And I brought it to the band. I said, man,
Hey, thank you for doing it. I texted him to do that. If you could find the vocal version of the Newgrass Revival Baton Rouge, just pop it in anytime,
yeah.
Okay? I am sitting at a Vanderbilt, no, I don't know. Oh, MTSU was playing at LSU in Baton Rouge on a Saturday night. Of course, they start drinking on Wednesday. Okay.
Of course.
And there's 100,000 people singing along to you guys.
Really?
With Baton Rouge.
Wow.
They play that. It's like third quarter. And, of course, John. So 100,000 people were singing that song.
Wow.
And I'm sitting up there. I know those guys because they're my friend.
Well, when we we had recorded that, it's funny. We all got our record deals around the same time. And Garth Brooks, we had met him a few times in Oklahoma. He opened for us. And that's the story.
Think of that.
That's the story of the
Garth Brooks opened for Newgrass Revival.
Yeah. And one time he actually formed a bluegrass band when we played at a place called Horse Thief Canyon. And so he formed a bluegrass band for the day and opened for us.
Here we go. Let this breathe.
Ours is one key higher.
Okay. Yeah. I don't need Harry Carey talking. Let's listen to John sing a little bit. There you go. Are you a fiddle player who plays the mandolin? or mandolin? Are you a mandolin player who plays the fiddle? Because you
yes.
are, yeah.
Y'all, I'd probably think of myself as a mandolin player first.
Really?
But
was the fiddle was where you, okay, but when you were, what, 13, 14, 15, 14, 15, 16, you were the junior national fiddle champion.
Yes.
I always think of you as a fiddle player first. I don't
well,
know.
Good. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
It's just glad to be thought of. But,
I ponder it.
Well, I started on mandolin and about age 11, and then around 13, started picking up the fiddle and messing with
yeah.
it. And we went out to Weezer, Idaho. Weezer. and they called that contest out there the National Fiddle Championship. So in the junior division at age 15, 16, and 17, I won. So I was called the National Junior Champion at the time. And it's so funny, they had a Fiddler's Hall of Fame out there. And of course, I, being from Kentucky, would go out and, you know, there would be a perception that every kid in Kentucky had a fiddle in their hand,
yeah.
right? And I didn't meet another kid my age that played the fiddle till I went to Weezer, Idaho, where I met kids from the Northwest and out West in that contest and, you know, made lifelong friends. And we got a lot, it was so much fun to have, wow, other geeks like me that play a fiddle. But I was the only one that didn't wear cowboy style shirts and a hat or something, and like a striped t-shirt like the Beach Boys might wear.
Yeah. That's,
and so in the Fiddler Hall of Fame, for a number of years, they would have a picture from each year of the winners, and the 3 years that I won, there were three blank frames. Fiddler's Hall of Fame. I think finally they put one in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that was good.
But
you're
a lot of good
your
fiddlers
father, Charlie Bush. I was lucky enough to have met him. You had four sisters
yep.
growing up. Talk about his influence on you, because he was a hell of a fiddle player, right?
Well, he was. Well,
or he was a fiddle player.
He was a fiddle player.
Okay. Yeah,
he was a fiddler. He used to say, I can't play one, but I can sure tell you who can.
Yeah,
and. But he loved to play, and it was interesting. He would host fiddle jam sessions at our house and have fiddlers come over. And I don't remember him, like, joining in those jam sessions. He just loved to hear the other guys play. And so his love of fiddle music got me sort of listening to music, and he would buy these records by the great Grand Ole Opry fiddler named Tommy Jackson. And Tommy Jackson, on these fiddle records, would also have a mandolin playing along in unison with the melodies. And somehow the sound of both those instruments, you know, just really appealed to me. And at the time, it was the mandolin that appealed to me the most on playing along with Tommy Jackson on these fiddle records. And so my dad's love of fiddling, of course, rubbed off on me. And then when we got to come to Nashville and actually meet Roy Acuff. Now, see,
Roy Acuff. There's yeah. a question coming there.
I mean, meeting Roy Acuff for my dad was like me getting to meet a Beatle.
Right.
You know, so Acuff and Hank Williams and Hawkshaw Hawkins those guys, those were my dad's heroes. He was a country music fan. I was the one that was the bluegrass fan. But my dad loved bluegrass music as well because it had a fiddle in the band.
Did you turn down Roy Acuff?
I did, yeah. I did.
How do you turn down Roy Acuff?
Well, looking back, perhaps it might not have been the wisest of choices, but I don't know. It was just where I was. I was 18 years old. And graduated from high school.
Warren County High School, the Dragons.
That's right.
Fellow alums.
Dragons, yes.
Yep.
I'd been in the Dragon marching band. But we'd been coming down to Nashville. And, Mr. Acuff had one of the most fantastic fiddle players named Howdy Forrester that ever played the fiddle in his band. But Howdy didn't want to go on the road anymore, and so Roy was getting other people to go on the road with him, and Howdy would just stay in Nashville and work at Acuff Rose Publishing. So how can I explain this where I don't sound like a total idiot for turning down the king of country music? But, well, one, the kind of music I was interested in was either bluegrass or rock and roll. And, I mean, I actually left home the day after high school. I set out for California with the plan that I'm going to join the Byrds. I wanted to be in the Byrds. And, of course, they didn't know that or know me.
Roger McGuinn didn't.
But Clarence White, with their guitar player, was my hero. Anyhow, but there was a couple of reasons was that, again, I wasn't really wanting to play country music that was of Roy Acuff's generation of country music, and didn't really listen to country music that much. Now, I mean, over the years, I'm more of a fan of country music now than I actually was growing up as a kid, and I was a fan of it. I've always listened to it, but it was either bluegrass or rock and roll for me, and there was another reason that Mr. Acuff's first tour where he was going in 1970, he was going to Vietnam to play. And there was this story that had about 2 months before I got that offer of that Hank Snow, the Opry great, had been in Vietnam playing for troops. And the hotel he had just checked out of where they were staying in whatever city, I don't remember, but about 2 hours after Hank and the band checked out of that hotel, it was completely leveled and bombed for like the whole block. And that really scared me to think, wow, there's not really a front line over there.
Well, and at age 18, the draft was,
I was of prime draft age. I was Vietnam draft age. Uh-huh. And the whole thing just kind of terrified me, I'll admit it. And I didn't really want to play the kind of music that was my father's music, because bluegrass music was what I was really turned on to, and Roy Acuff's music wasn't that. And then the thought of the first tour going to Vietnam, that was just like, you know what, I'm not there. And I originally had planned on going to Western Kentucky University and majoring in violin, but I was working at the Holiday Inn on Bowling Green, and these two guys from Louisville showed up literally the night after I had knocked over a cart of dishes and broken about 300 dishes. That greatly weighs into your $47 a week paycheck. it cut right into it. And these two guys from the Bluegrass Alliance showed up and asked me if I wanted to move to Louisville and play guitar. So I moved to Louisville to play guitar in the Bluegrass Alliance, and didn't end up registering and going to Western Kentucky University. So
I did it for us.
I went to what they call Bluegrass College, which is playing five nights a week in a noisy bar with one microphone.
And not old enough to drink in it, right?
No,
old enough to play in it. No, correct. Back then maybe you could.
No. You could work in a bar at 18.
Okay,
but you just
couldn't drink.
You sure better not drink. Yeah,
we need to take a break. Yeah, let's take a break. We'll be back and wrap it up. Sam Bush on 94.9 The Fan. What is that?
That's Riding That Bluegrass Train.
With Sam Bush on vocal, the backup vocalist of Newgrass Revival. Tuesday night at the Ryman. What are you doing Tuesday night?
Tuesday at the Ryman. Well, we're also going to be there. A great group is opening for us called Sister Sadie. And they are one of the most popular bands, all-female band, and just a fine bunch of musicians. So Sister Sadie will be opening up. And then me and my band with Chris Brown on drums, Todd Parks bass, Stephen Mogin guitar, Wes Corbett on the five string. And so we'll be doing our combination Newgrass, Bluegrass. We're going to have a couple of guests come in and play with us that I don't want to say.
Yeah.
I don't want to say Garth Brooks is coming. Oh, did I? No, just kidding. But
yes.
Just kidding. No, but we are going to have a couple of guests. Yeah. But it shouldn't be announced because anything could happen. Maybe they don't make it, right?
Yeah.
But we're going to be playing our Newgrass and Bluegrass at the Ryman. Come on out and hear us because maybe we probably do tilt a little more towards Bluegrass. within our band, especially on this Tuesday night bluegrass series, because we do regularly in our shows feature electric instruments and it's such a well-rounded group we have, and it's everything is what you mentioned. It's rock and roll, it's bluegrass, it's newgrass, it's reggae, it's gospel sometimes. So we want to play to that audience, and it's just a great series to get to be on. I'm really fortunate to still be playing at the Ryman. Heck, Greg, at this age, we're just fortunate to be up on a Saturday morning.
Hey, by the way, this afternoon, 4 o'clock, Nashville Cats, last home game of the season. Come on up, salute the military, all of the stuff. The first place, Nashville Cats at F&M Bank Arena, Clarksville Arena.
Yes.
The last regular season home game. You got to get you up there, okay?
I'd love to go.
Yep.
I'd love to.
Thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful, When you're Roy's meat service, I mean, what if you can't have fun here? You just can't have fun.
Yeah. And sambush.com, right?
It is, yes.
Yeah, just do that as well. So, Jake, take us on out. Everybody, thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. If you love great games and a little extra excitement to your day, I got something fun for you. Chumba Casino and I have teamed up to create an exclusive online social casino game. It's called Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's fun and free to play, just like all your favorites from Chumba Casino. And every spin brings 10,000 ways to keep the good times going. Check it out and play for free today at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No.